This is the fourth day of this November 2008 seven-day session. And today we'll finish up reading from our text of the session thus far called Zen Dawn, which are the collection of the early Zen texts that were rediscovered in the 20th century in the Dunhuang Caves in northwest China. We're reading from the record of Dao Xin, Chan Master Dao Xin, who was the successor to Sun San. Bodhisattvas of profound practice enter birth and death to transform and deliver living beings without any of the views of sentimental love. If you see sentient beings as having birth and death, yourself as the subject able to liberate them, and the sentient beings as the objects being liberated, then you are not to be called a bodhisattva. Liberating sentient beings is like liberating emptiness. Has there ever been any coming or going? The Diamond Sutra says, in the final liberation of numberless beings, in reality, there are no beings gaining final liberation. Well, this goes right to the heart of the experience of Zen, which is grasping the emptiness, the no-thingness of things, the emptiness of phenomena, including beings, human beings, dogs and cats, horses and cattle, flowers, worms, fish and birds, ultimately are empty, meaning without any enduring fixed substance to them, us. Can't emphasize how important, how central this is to Buddhist understanding, the Zen experience, is seeing this other side that few people in the world ever see. Most people, this world, this reality, is just this movement of things and people and beings, phenomena, this coming and going, birth and death, rising and falling. But there's this other side, that which is unmoving, unchanging, birthless, unborn, undying, eternal. We talked earlier in this session in Taisho about the distinction between a bodhisattva and a Buddha, where a bodhisattva still has some faint attachment to the idea of beings who need to be liberated. Whereas a Buddha is without that thought of other in need of saving. And yet, with a Buddha, a full Buddha, there is still this liberating that happens. Liberating of what or whom? Nothing. No liberation. We go through this every time we chant the Prajnaparamita. Nor is there pain or cause of pain or cease in pain or noble path that leads to pain. Attainment too is emptiness. this reference to the, where it says about bodhisattvas of profound practice have none of the views of sentimental love. This means pity, you might say. There's no sentimentality. There's just responding to what's needed, what's called for. There's no melodrama about it, and yet there's the response. Well, here, this definition, this strict definition of a bodhisattva is still with this feigned attachment of liberating beings, is not exactly the same here. You know, one of the tricky things about learning Buddhist doctrine is that their terms are defined differently in different places. Here, defining a bodhisattva as someone without that attachment. We don't need to concern ourselves with that. We need to be able to do is respond ourselves when we're facing a situation where response is called for, not hold back. This means being aware, first of all. How can we respond if we're not aware of a need? Can't say this often enough. This practice is not just for our own happiness. It is to become vessels of service, helping others. If we don't have this responsiveness to those who are in need, then our practice is not mature. It goes on. The first stage bodhisattva first witnesses everything as empty, then witnesses everything as not empty. This is non-discriminating wisdom. And this is form. Form is emptiness. It is not emptiness that wipes out form. Form, by nature, is empty. Bodhisattvas cultivate and learn emptiness as their realization. When new students directly see emptiness, this is just seeing emptiness. It is not real emptiness. Those who cultivate the path until they find real emptiness do not view things as empty or not empty. They have no views. You must understand properly the meaning of form and emptiness. This statement we'll reread. When new students directly see emptiness, this is just seeing emptiness. It is not real emptiness. In other words, there's just the glimpse into the emptiness aspect of reality, the no-thingness of things. Now, this is not the same as grasping in one's total being the non-dual nature of form and emptiness. It's getting a peek at this realm that is beyond form, a formless realm. This formless realm we could call the absolute realm, the eternal, the ultimate, the undifferentiated. We're warned in the Firming Faith and Mind, to encounter the absolute is not yet enlightenment. He goes on, to learn the use of mind, you must have the mind road illuminated and pure, and you must understand the characteristics of phenomena completely and clearly. Only then are you fit to be a teacher to people. Moreover, this requires inner and outer to correspond, and theory and practice not to contradict each other. You must break with written and spoken words and with contrived versions of the sagely path. In unity and purity, you experience for yourself the fruits of the path. This phrase, it requires inner and outer to correspond. This is the hard part of long practice, is not the whatever insights we may have, but then to integrate these insights into our activity, our moving through life. We can have the experience, even an experience of awakening, but there is almost always a lag where we know the truth of no self, no self and other, and yet through habit force, we continue to react to people and situations in ways that betray that insight. This is the work of a lifetime. And theory and practice not to contradict each other. Same thing, basically. To walk the walk. Goes on, there are people who teach living beings for the sake of fame and profit without comprehending the characteristics of the ultimate Dharma. They do not recognize relative degrees of depth and shallowness in their students' capacities and causal affinities. They give their seal of approval to everyone, to people who seem enlightened but are otherwise. This is most painful. It is a great disaster. Whenever someone seems illuminated and pure in their perception of mind, they immediately give their approval. These people are gravely damaging the teaching of enlightenment. They are deceiving themselves and deceiving others. People who use mind with such divergences from the correct path and present this appearance have not found mind. Those who truly find mind recognize it clearly for themselves. After a long while, the Dharma eye opens by itself and is well able to distinguish what is empty and false. This reference to those who teach for the sake of fame and profit is clearly an old problem. One of the most outrageous contemporary examples of that is a teacher, a Zen teacher, who for a donation of $50,000 will enable you to hang with him for a few days, 5 days. I guess that's $10,000 a day. We'll skipping a few pages here. It continues, be constantly mindful that the six sense faculties are empty and still, and that you have no hearing or seeing. That is, it's not a matter of having. It's a matter of perceiving. The Bequeathed Teaching Sutra says, "This time is the middle of the night, still and soundless." That's the end of the quote. And then this Daoxin says, "You must know that the Dharma taught by the Tathagata takes empty stillness as the basis. Be ever mindful that the six senses are empty and still. Be constantly as if in the middle of the night. What is seen and heard by day are all things external to the body. Let it be always empty and pure within the body, preserving unity without stirring. With this eye of emptiness and purity, focus the attention and observe one thing. No matter whether it is day or night, focus the energy so that it does not move. When the mind is about to run off and scatter, quickly gather it back. It is like tying a bird's foot so that when it wishes to fly away, it is held fast. Meditate without stopping all the time. When purified, mind will stabilize itself." So this point that the six senses are empty and still, there's what is known as the three wheels. The three wheels are the one who is sensing, the object being sensed, and the act of sensing. So there's the hearer, there is the sound that is heard, and there is the act of hearing. And the point here is that all three of these are fundamentally empty. There's no substance to them. It's a process. Processes aren't substance. So there's no thing hearing or thing being heard. And if there's neither subject nor object, then there can't be any substance to the hearing itself. It's really all quite mysterious when you reflect on this. And that is a type of Buddhist meditation, is to reflect on this whole process of perception. Who or what is hearing? Where does the sound come from? Really? Who is hearing it? What is hearing it? The Vimalakirti Sutra says, "Gathering in mind is the site of enlightenment. This is a method for gathering in mind." The word concentration comes from a root word that means to bring together or to gather in. The Lotus Sutra says, having eliminated sleep and gathered in mind for countless ages, by the accomplished merit of this, he was able to engender meditative concentrations. This was said also in the Bequeathed Teaching Sutra. Quote, mind is the ruler of the five faculties. Control it in one place, and all will be accomplished. It is our discriminating consciousness that interprets the data of the senses, the five senses. So there's this, the pure act, let's say, of hearing. Just that pure experience. The sound. It's just the hearing of that, immediately. But what happens 99% of the time is we build on that sound. We have a thought about it or an association, and then more on top of that. And before long, we're off and running. We're off in a train of thought or thoughts about that, or long since forgetting about that and just going off in another direction entirely. This is what the Japanese call nen. The first, the successive nen. The first nen is just the simple, direct experience. Second nen is a thought about it. Third nen is a thought about that, or a second thought, and then so forth. And this is a very meticulous this comes from a meticulous examination of how the mind works. Sooner or later, we can all confirm this, that this is what takes our mind afield. So Chinese master Lin Chi said, just learn to cut successive nen, and this is worth more than 10 years of pilgrimage. He's saying, don't waste your time wandering all over for years and years and years, meeting different teachers. You can do far better just looking intently and noticing when the mind starts to move on to thoughts and just cut it off. Gets into some interesting analogies for this. Those who hear should practice. Don't be doubtful and confused. It is like a person learning archery. At first he shoots at large targets. By and by he can hit smaller and smaller ones. Then he can hit a single feather. Then hit it and smash it into 100 pieces. Then hit one of the hundredths. Then he can shoot the arrow before with the arrow after and hit the notch so the arrows line up one after another and he does not let any arrows fall. He goes on, this is a metaphor for practicing the path, concentrating the mind from thought instant to thought instant. This is the word nen. It's sometimes translated as thought instant. In Kanongyo, we translate it simply as moment. This moment arises from mind this moment itself is not. In the original Japanese, it's nen. Nen nen ju shin gi, nen nen fu ri shin. Concentrating the mind from thought instant to thought instant, going on continuously from mind moment to mind moment without any interruptions, so that correct mindfulness is not broken and appears before you. Another sutra says, with the arrow of wisdom, shoot through the gate of triple liberation. Let the arrows line up and hold each other up so that none fall. So, speaking here of the continuousness of our attention, this is what is so difficult, but not impossible. We can see how we get better at catching the mind sooner, noticing and catching it and getting back to the practice, so that there are shorter and shorter intervals in which the mind is wandering. And we can just keep shaving it down more and more and more until we're continuously absorbed in just this moment, and this, and this, and this. We're here, fully here, now. Does take tremendous effort, but there is a momentum that builds in doing this. This is the momentum that anyone who's been to Sesshin before is familiar with. Again, practice is like drilling for fire. If you stop before it gets hot, though you may wish to get fire, it is impossible. Or like pumping a old-fashioned water pump. Can't do it halfway. You can't do it for a while and then give up. You have to stay with it, persevere. As difficult as this may sound, it is within the capacity of everyone. It just takes training of the mind. It takes practice, diligent practice. We do get better at it. There's a line in the repentance verse, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the past were like us. We will in the future become Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. This is the great promise of the fact of no self, that we're not stuck with a self. We're not stuck with our afflictions, our shortcomings. It's the whole point of practice and training, is that we can reshape ourselves by training the mind, training our attention, on mind. He goes on, the secret essence of this Dharma cannot be transmitted to the wrong person. It is not that we are reluctant to pass it on. It is that we fear that people will not believe and will fall into the crime of slandering the Dharma. We must choose the right people We cannot be in a hurry or speak hastily. It really sounds like he's addressing teachers or potential teachers. Take care, take care. Though the Dharma sea is immeasurable, it is traveled in a single word. Mu. When you find the meaning, you forget the word. Not using even a single word, yet knowing with complete comprehension like this. This is getting the Buddha's meaning. In Japan, a student who's working on Mu, when she or he goes to Doksan, says, "My practice is Muji. Ji means word. So my practice is the word Mu." We're doing fine just saying my practice is Mu. But it is a good reminder that we need, for people who are working on Mu or on another koan, what or who, that word has to be in the mind. When our thoughts become fewer, we can sometimes, our concentration can kind of drift into a state of emptiness, mental emptiness, where the Mu, let's say, the Mu kind of gets forgotten. And it can be quite a deep state of absorption, but if the Mu, if the word isn't there, then you're just kind of treading water. It may be a very pleasant, gratifying experience to be. It's a samadhi-like experience in this emptiness. But it's a conditioned state. If it will pass until one breaks through. And to break through, the word has to be there. We have to get it back up, even when if we have resistance to doing so. We'd rather just bliss out in an empty mind. But we've got to bring it up, get the Mu back in the mind, and keep chewing away at it. It's only by resolving this question, whatever it is, it's only by resolving it, breaking through it, that we can, we don't have this backsliding. A little more here. When body and mind are properly attuned, when mind and spirit are at peace, then in deep mystic fusion, the breath is pure and cool. Slowly gather in mind until the path of the spirit is pure and sharp, and the mind ground is illumined and pure. As you perceive clearly and distinctly, inner and outer are empty and pure. This is the mind's inherent nirvana. With this nirvana, the mind of the sages is manifest. If there's just one or two words that the common person may know about Buddhism, it's the word Buddhism, it's the word nirvana. And there is this exotic notion of nirvana as being some place that you get to eventually. But we can experience nirvana in our own samadhi. It's not a place. How could it be a place? It's a realm of consciousness, or a realm that is beyond consciousness. These four words that we chant in the Kanongyo, eternal, selfless, joyous, pure, these are said to be the four qualities of nirvana. Or we could say samadhi. It's a calculated risk to use the word samadhi, for me to talk about samadhi, the risk being it becomes another thing that people get attached to, another concept in the mind. And I've noticed in recent years that people seem to be using the word samadhi in too loosely, too casually. I have people who come and casually say, I got into a samadhi. If it were a samadhi, they wouldn't say it casually. This is something that is, you never forget. Once you've been in a true samadhi, you never forget that. It's life-changing. Never mind awakening, just samadhi. It's a profound state of freedom, illumined awareness, brightness, and utter, indescribable stillness. It really, you know it really is a glimpse into eternity. Now, there are different degrees of samadhi. And maybe when people say that, maybe it's true that they have some kind of a light, tentative samadhi. But really, it's just becoming absolutely one with the practice, beyond any trace of thought, any notion of self or other. They always go together. Goes on here. Thus, the profound luminous one never ends. It remains forever shining bright. This is called the Buddha nature, the enlightened real identity. Those who see Buddha nature leave behind forever birth and death. They are called people who transcend the world. In general, methods of relinquishing personal existence, or we could say transcending the self, begin with stabilizing and emptying mind and make mind and objects quiescent and still. These methods recast thinking into mystic quiescence so that mind does not stir and the reality nature of mind is still and settled. Then you cut off grasping at objects. Deeply fused, solidified in purity, mind is empty, everywhere equal, peaceful, and still. Material forces are totally gone. You abide in the pure body of reality, no longer subject to states of being. This is transcending mind states. Samadhi is not a mind state. It's the absence of state, any state. No coming or going, no rising or falling. Well, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.